The Destiny Foundation is proud to present this four-lecture series entitled The Basic Books of Judaism, recorded live in Jerusalem in the summer 2002 with Rabbi Beryl Wein. This is the fourth lecture in the series, number 498, entitled The Codes of Jewish Law by Rabbi Beryl Wein. We hope you enjoy.
Tonight's lecture, which is the final one in our series on the basic books of Judaism, concerns itself with the works of halakha, with the works, so to speak, the legal works of the Torah and of the Jewish people that have been developed over the centuries, really over the millennia. The Talmud gives us a basic rule about studying Torah. La suke shmatza aliba de hilchata. That we study the entire theory of the Torah and everything that's in the Talmud in order to come to a conclusion. The conclusion being practical human behavior. What is permitted, what is not permitted, what is right, what is wrong, what is our custom and what should not be done. That it should come to a practical decision, so to speak, to a bottom line. And even though the discussion in the Talmud many times is very esoteric, very theoretical, it's not at all oriented towards coming to a decision. But nevertheless, the student of the Talmud will always realize that the Talmud is goal-oriented. There is somewhere a decision to be made and arrived at. Many times the Talmud itself does the work for us. It tells us what the decision is, but many times it does not. Because of that, and because of the fact that we cannot have more than one Torah floating around at one time, the Talmud always warns us that you're not allowed to construct Jewish learning in a way that there should be more than one Torah, that there should be shtei Torah, two types of Torah. So therefore, in order to avoid that, in the time of the Gaonim, the Babylonian Gaonim, in the 7th, 8th, 9th, and 10th centuries, began the work of constructing books of halakha, books that would tell us what the practical decision of the Talmud was. And these books, as they have developed over the centuries, form the basis for our legal corpus. They form the basis for our behavior in Jewish life. And in effect, they tell us what to do as a Jew, how to behave, what we're supposed to do. They set the standards for us. The earliest books that we have from the time of the Gaonim were sometimes called a Sidur. Now, we use the word Sidur for the order of prayer. But the word Sidur, as it was originally used until about the 14th or 15th century, meant, as the word means, an order. But not just an order of prayer, but an order of life. What you're supposed to do. And therefore, we find that the works of the Gaonim, the Babylonian great men, most of whom lived in Baghdad, were always attached to a Sidur. They were called something that was in order. And the two main works that we have, one is called the Shi'iltot Rav Achoi Gaon. In the 9th century, not clear whether it was the 9th or the 10th, but in that period of time, there was a man, Rav Achoi, who was the Gaon in Sura, the head of the yeshiva. And he constructed a book which he claimed was a family book. In other words, what they did is follow the order of the portions of the Torah and what questions were asked Friday night at the table. And then he wrote the answers. And so therefore, this first, almost original, halachic book that we have follows the order of the parshiyot of the Chumash, the parshiyot of the Bible. And that's the order. So there's no categories. We know that the Torah can discuss Shabbat in 10 different places, as it does. The Torah can discuss many, many halachot, many, many laws in different places, not necessarily in one given place. So this book also meanders all over the place because it depends on the parsha. And it's called She'iltot, the questions, because these are the questions that were asked. If those were the questions that were asked, he had a very intellectual Friday night table, a table of scholars. At my Friday night table, we never quite get to those questions, obviously because they realize that the host doesn't have the answers. But the level of the questions go to the heart of the matter of the discussion of the Talmud, and his answers go to that level. Now, the She'iltot was a pretty much forgotten sefer, but it was resurrected in the 19th century by the great Rabbi Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, the Netziv, the head of the yeshiva in Valozhin. When he was a young man, very young man, he began to write a commentary on the She'iltot. And this commentary, called the Emek HaNetziv, became a work of monumental scholarship. And it established his reputation as the great scholar. And it had the ability within it to revive this book that probably very few people looked at for 1,000 years. And it reintroduced it to the Jewish scholarly world. There also is a scholarly edition of it that Professor Mirsky, Rabbi Mirsky from Brooklyn, put out a 5-volume work on it to correct the text and to compare the copyist notes, etc. So that the She'iltot today is a live book. It's a book that's used. It's a research book, but it's alive. Whereas if I would have told you this maybe 150, 200 years ago, the She'iltot was consigned almost to oblivion. So there's a mazel, there's a good fortune in books also. Because there are great books, you know, that just lie there. And there are books that perhaps are not as great, but are popular and are included in the curriculum. And everybody knows about them, and everybody studies them. So authors need a mazel also, aside from the scholarship that's involved. But there's a matter of mazel, there's a matter of luck, fate, so to speak, as to which books will be followed and which will not be followed. The second book from the time of the Gaonim is called the Bahag, Beis Hei Gimel, which is the abbreviation Baal Halochos Gdolos. And this book, probably written in North Africa, it's the first attempt, really, to organize the Talmud, not in terms of explaining the Talmud, but in terms of coming to the decisions of the Talmud. Now, this book was very popular. Rashi used it. The Tosafot quoted very, very often. It became like the basic book, the primer, for all works of halacha. People looked at the Bahag. And not only that, the Bahag had a reputation, Tosafot says, Kol Dvorov Divrei Kabbalahim, all of his words have a tradition, meaning that it's not just the work of a single author, but that he's the conduit of the tradition of the Jewish people from the time of the Talmud and even earlier as to what the law should be, how Jews did behave. And therefore, because of that, the Bahag was held in very high esteem and people were very wary to disagree with its conclusions simply because of the fact that it had the weight of authority of the ages behind it. But the Bahag would not also be popular, so to speak. It would not be set up the books of halacha for us. it wouldn't appeal to the masses of Israel, even to the masses of the scholars of Israel. So that brings us to probably what the heart of the lecture is, regarding four or five works of halacha that are the product of the Middle Ages. And that these works are the basic works of all of Jewish law. And even today, any compendium of Jewish law begins with them. Quoting, following, realizing that this is the source of everything that we know regarding halacha, regarding what the conclusions of the Talmud were. The first of the books is known by the name of its author. It's called the Rif. The Rif stands for Rabbi Yitzchok Fassi, or he's called the Alfas, Alfasi, from Fez. Fas is Fez, in Morocco. Now, the Jews in Morocco, we're talking here the early 11th century, so there were two main centers of Jewish life, one in Spain and one in North Africa. The one in North Africa had begun by the fact that shipwrecked rabbis ended up in North Africa. The famous legend of the four rabbis. There were four rabbis that were sent out from Baghdad to collect money for the yeshiva, which no yeshiva has had money ever. And so they always sent people to collect money. And their ship was captured by pirates. And the custom of the time was that the pirates held the captives for ransom. The pirates especially kept Jews for ransom because they knew that Jews would be ransomed. Other people many times were not ransomed and the pirates just killed them. But a Jew was worth money. Because we have the law that you can even take a Sefer Torah and sell it in order to redeem a Jewish captive. So there is no priority higher than redeeming a Jewish captive. And so they knew that. We'll see that because of that, the Jews sometimes had to reverse their policy. Sometimes they purposely did not redeem, or the captives did not allow themselves to be redeemed simply because of the fact that they were being extorted. They realized they were being taken advantage of. That was the case with the great Rabbi Meir of Rottenburg, who was taken prisoner by a count in Austria and held in prison for 13 years. He refused to allow the Jews to redeem him because of the fact that the price was exorbitant. And if the price were paid, so then they would do it again. We have this problem today with hostage taking, God forbid. What do you do? If you succumb to the demands of the hostage takers, then they only guarantee that there'll be more hostages. On the other hand, if you don't do anything, so then God forbid, terrible things can happen to them. So it's a terrible moral dilemma. Jewish communities always face that moral dilemma, what to do, how to deal with it. Here we have to deal with it on a national level. What does the state of Israel do to get back its prisoners, etc., etc.? And we see that we have had very mixed success, to put it mildly, in dealing with this matter, and that people that were released from prison in the exchange have come back to haunt us many times over. The sheikh from Hamas and others were all released when they had to get the Mossad people out of Jordan, things like that. So it's very difficult to know what to do. But what happened here was that the four rabbis were put on the block, so to speak. And the Jewish communities bought them. And the greatest of the rabbis, the leading rabbi, Rabbi Hushiel, the Jews of Kairouan, which is a city in Morocco, they redeemed him and they brought him to be the rabbi there, the head to found the yeshiva, and that he should be the scholar for them. They were unable to attract a rabbi of that stature. No one would come to them. People wouldn't willingly leave Babylonia to come to Morocco. So now they grabbed him. He had a son, Hananel, the famous Rabbeinu Hananel, who established in Kairouan really the most famous yeshiva. And they made Morocco a center of Torah, strong center of Torah. Other rabbis went to other places. One went to Bari in Italy, which for a period of time was a great Jewish center of scholarship. And some went to Spain. They were distributed everywhere. It was like the Jewish world was pollinated with seed so that the Torah would spread. So in Morocco, this Rabbi Yitzchok Alfasi headed the yeshiva in Fez. He was the successor to Rabbeinu Hananel. And what he did, he made an abridged Talmud. He took the Talmud, he took out all of the stories from the Talmud, he took out all of the conversations, he took out all of the discussions back and forth, he just left the bare bones being what the law was. So that what he wrote is barely 25-27% of the entire Talmud. Most of the Talmud is omitted. And he intended his work to be, to a certain extent, the substitute for the Talmud. Because instead of going through the entire discussion, the questions and answers, the debates back and forth, here's the end, right? This is it. He has very interesting things that he wrote in his commentary, in his Talmud, in the Alphas. And the Alphas became the basic book of Psak, the basic book of Halacha, the basic book for Sephardic Jewry. And it was written in Aramaic, the language of the Talmud itself. It's made its way to the small Ashkenazic community that existed in France at the time, but it did not have major impact. And he is practically not quoted at all by Rashi or Tosafot or any of the Ashkenazic scholars. He died 2 years before Rashi was born. 2 years before Rashi was born, he passed away. And he died in 1038. Rashi's born in 1040. But his work is the basic halachic work for Sephardic Jewry. But it's a work that, again, suffers from the fact that it is as disorganized as the Talmud is. Follows exactly the order of the Talmud. And therefore, to a certain extent, it's also all over the place. And if you want to look something up, it's a difficult book to deal with because you have to know where it is in the Talmud in order to know where it would be by him. So you had now, we had the Bahag, and we had the Shiltos, and we had the Rif. None of these Sforim really gave us a construct of halacha, of works that would follow us through. The great change in the view of halacha comes with Rabbi Moshe ben Maimon, the Rambam. In the 12th century, the Rambam sets out to do something that no one else ever imagined could be done. The Rambam organized the entire Torah by subject matter. And he wrote a 14-volume work called the Mishneh Torah. The Yod HaChazoka, Yod in Hebrew, Yud Dalet is 14. So it's 14 volumes. And the Rambam took upon himself what no one else would. That's why they said about the Rambam, Mimoshe ad Moshe lokom kemoshe. From the time of their teacher Moses till the time of the Rambam, we didn't have anybody like the Rambam. Which is really a mouthful. Really is the ultimate compliment that could ever be paid. The Rambam took the Torah and he organized it He organized it into general subject matters, into particular subject matters, into subdivisions, into chapters, into paragraphs, into numbered halachas. It is still the work of the ages, and no one has come close. And the Rambam's work is the basis of all Jewish scholarship, Talmudic scholarship in the world today. And if you'll pick up any Torah journal, or you'll walk into any yeshiva in the world, if you read the Torah journal, you'll see the Rambam is mentioned almost in every article. If you'll go to any Talmud class that deals in depth, you will always hear the Rambam quoted. You can't move without the Rambam. Once he was there, the Rambam is like Rashi. After they're there, how did we ever exist without it? But the Rambam didn't come along until the late 1100s as far as the Yorah HaZokah is concerned. The Rambam also made great claims for his book, justified claims. But any new innovation in Jewish life brings about opposition. That's a given. So no matter how great the accomplishment is, how noble, how beneficial, there always are naysayers. And that should not be seen as something that's purely negative because of the fact that it forces you to defend yourself and it forces you to make a better work because you know that the work will be criticized. If everybody stands up and cheers, so then, you know, you leave it alone. The Rambam's work had a number of major defects. Its one major defect is no one knew his sources. He says, this is the law. Where did he get that from? So the Rambam himself has a wonderful story about himself, that a man traveled a far distance to come to his house in Fostad, outside of Cairo in Egypt, and the man pointed out to him a halacha that the Rambam wrote in the Yorah HaZokah, and he said, Rebbe, can you tell me, where did you get this from? I couldn't find it anywhere. So the Rambam says, I told him it was in Maseches Gittin. It was in the tractate Gittin in the Talmud. So the man said, no, I'm sorry, Rebbe, it isn't. To be able to tell the Rambam that it isn't. So the Rambam says, we took out Maseches Gittin and we went through the entire Masechta, he says. Which is, in the yeshiva world takes years to do. He went through the entire Masechta and he was right. It's not there. The Rambam said, I was shaken and I didn't remember where it was, where I got it from. And the man left. A half hour after he left, the Rambam says, I remembered that it's in Yevamos. I found it. And I sent a special messenger on horseback to bring him back. And I showed him where the halacha came from. But the Rambam says, from that I see how right my critics were. Because if I don't remember where I got it from, how are they going to know where I got it from? He writes in another letter that if he had to do it over again, he would include all of his sources. It's interesting that the commentators of the Rambam attempted to make up for what he did not do, and to list all of his sources. But there are sources today that still are hidden from us. Where did the Rambam get it from? Where did he see it in the Talmud? Where is it? Rabbi Kasher, who was a very brilliant scholar, he wrote the Torah Shlema. So he found a manuscript called the Mechilta of Reb Shim ben Yochoi, which is a book that was composed at the time of the Tanoim, right after Rabbi Akiva, and it was not known to us, at least for the last few hundred years. And in that Mechilta of Reb Shim ben Yochoi, he found many of the hidden halachas that the Rambam quoted, for which we had no source. And therefore he theorizes, probably correctly, that the Rambam had that book in front of him. We didn't, but he had that book in front of him, and therefore, based on what he saw in that book. That's where he got those halachas from. There may be other books that we don't have that the Rambam could have had. But in any event, this Yod HaChazokah was just the enormous creation of the ages. Even with all the criticism that was put upon it. And the other criticism was the fact that they held that the Rambam was too philosophical, mixed the philosophy in with the halacha. The Rambam was a controversial figure, even though he was the greatest man of the age, but he had his detractors. This book, the Yod HaChazokah, is perfectly organized, but it's the Rambam's system of organization. And it's interesting that no one followed that system of organization, even though it's the most logical, the most meticulous. It's the perfect outline. You know, sometimes you're taught in school how to make an outline. This is the one that follows the book, how to make an outline. How to have the general categories, how to have subcategories, how to have chapters, how to have subchapters, how to have paragraphs, how to have individual laws, follows an order, magnificent in its order. The order is so great and so important that many times we learn something from the order. Why did the Rambam put this in this chapter? Why did he put this rule first and then this rule second? He's telling us something just by the order of the way he placed things, because the order is so meticulous. The Rambam's work spread like wildfire. And it was popularized throughout the Sephardic world, but it was also popularized throughout Provence. The men of Lunel and other towns in Provence were great supporters of the Rambam, Montpellier, and the Rambam's greatest detractors were also found in Provence. And it also spread to the Ashkenazic world. Tosfos quotes the Rambam a few times, so there's really a dispute whether they mean the Rambam or not. They always say Rabbeinu Moshe, but they don't say Rabbeinu Moshe ben Maimon. But most of the commentators think that Tosfos is referring to the Rambam. But it makes no difference. The Rambam came to Ashkenazic Jewry through a man, a Rav, in the French village of Kotzi, C-O-U-C-Y, which is in northern France. Rabbeinu Moshe Mikotzi, one of the Balei Tosfos, and he wrote a book called Sefer Mitzvos Godol, the great book of mitzvot. It's called the Smag. In the Smag, in almost every paragraph, he quotes the Rambam. So that his book, which was accepted by Ashkenazic Jewry, became the conduit by which the Rambam came to Ashkenazic Jewry. Because he followed the Rambam almost 99% of the time. And we have that often, that sometimes if a book does not penetrate directly, if it's not popular on its own, so to speak, but it rides the coattails of another book, which makes the original book known and popular to everyone. So the Smag brings the Rambam into Ashkenazic Jewry. Once the Rambam is in, nobody's going to take him out. It is a book that cannot be ignored. And even though not everyone agreed with the Rambam's decisions in Halacha, but we would say that even today, certainly 90 to 95% of all halachic decisions follow the opinions of the Rambam. The Rambam is very formidable. Very difficult to say I don't agree with him. Now, when the Smag came out, so then different works of halacha began to appear amongst Ashkenazic Jewry. There's the Smag, Sefer Mitzvos Kotten. Then there was Trumas Hadeshen, written by Rabbi Yisroel Isserlin of Austria, in which he posed 354 questions. That's why it's called Deshen, because the numerical value of Deshen is 354, and 354 days make up the lunar year. And therefore, it's a question a day keeps the doctor away, right? Every day you were supposed to study one of the questions and the answer. And that became the halachic primer for Ashkenazic Jewry. The problem with that was that many felt that it was really not that reliable, since the same man made up the questions as the answers. And therefore, so to speak, heaven didn't come to his aid because the questions weren't real. But in any event, there was a great upsurge in halachic works by the Ashkenazim. Which brings us to the great posek of the Ashkenazim, Rabbi Osher ben Yechiel, who is known as the Rosh. The Rosh lives at the end of the 1200s, the beginning of the 1300s. He's a German Jew. He is the main disciple of Rabbi Meir of Rottenburg. And in fact, when Rabbi Meir was under arrest all the years, held as a hostage, the Rosh somehow was able to come and study with him. And the Rosh became the basic book of Psak, the basic book of Halacha of Ashkenazic Jewry. Now what the Rosh did is he followed this, not the order of the Rambam. No one follows the order of the Rambam. What he did is he followed the order of the Rif, meaning he took the Gemara, condensed it, and wrote his opinion as to what the halacha was, except that his book is written not in pure Aramaic as Talmudic Aramaic as is that of the Rif, but it's written in a jargon of Hebrew and Aramaic, which was the language of Tosfos. We have the Tosfos Arosh, one of the Balei Tosfos, and he was a great, great scholar. When his Rebbe was being held for so long a captive, the Rosh himself became nervous, because it came obvious to him that after Rabbi Meir, they'd come after him. And since they weren't getting any money for Rabbi Meir, so he was afraid that they would get money, they would come after him. He was in Regensburg, in Germany. So he escaped, and he came to Spain. He came to Toledo. Now here's an Ashkenazic rabbi that comes to a Sephardic city. And in the writings of the Rosh, you see the clash of cultures. He writes about many things that he found that he couldn't agree with. But he couldn't change them. And he decided many times that discretion was the better part of valor. And he didn't want to make a machlokas. So, for instance, on the question of Prusbul, on the seventh year, the Shemitah year, so they would write a document that would prevent the debts from being canceled, personal debts from being canceled, the Sephardim didn't write a Prusbul. The Spanish Jews, they said that the whole law did not apply any longer in their time, and they didn't write it, whereas the Ashkenazim held it, and we hold from it today as well. So he writes that in Toledo, he couldn't force them to write a... See, then he ended up, he wrote a Prusbul for himself and his family, that's all. But he couldn't make the Balabatim, he couldn't make the congregants in his synagogue, in his community, follow his opinion. Nevertheless, you have here this great example of the great Ashkenazic Rav becoming the rabbi in a Sephardi community in the city of Toledo. And here in the back of the Talmud, you will always find the Rosh. You'll always find his commentary. But remember, his commentary is not to explain the Gemara. His commentary is to come to the conclusion as to where the Gemara is going. And in the commentary, he oftentimes quotes real-life cases. He explains what happened. You get a picture of life under him, too. He had a famous son, Rabbi Yehuda. When the Rosh died in the early 1300s, 1312, so then his son became the Rav in Toledo. But he had another son who was a businessman, who became far more famous, Rabbi Yaakov. And Rabbi Yaakov is called the Baal HaTurim because he sat down and he codified Jewish law in four major volumes. And it is his order of the codes that became the accepted order of the codes. And he divided all Jewish law into Orach Chaim, the way of life, and the laws of prayer, of tefillin, of tzitzit, of the synagogue, of the holidays, of the Sabbath. That was one section. And then the second section was Yoredeya, which basically was devoted to the laws of kashrut, to the laws of kosher food, and also to the laws of monetary interest, also the laws of avelut, of mourning, and also the laws regarding family purity. That was the second section. The third section was Choshen Mishpat, which dealt with the laws of money, of business, of courts, the legal system. And the fourth section was Evan Ezer, which dealt with the laws of marriage and divorce, domestic relations. And that was the division that he made. And in the tour, in this book, he quotes the Rambam extensively, but he quotes his father more often. And therefore you have for the first time an amalgamum, a combination of Ashkenazic and Sephardic psak. And the tour almost always follows his father when there will be a dispute between his father and other authorities. The tour became extremely popular. He also wrote a commentary to Chumash that we have, the Baal HaTurim. So it's interesting that the son that was the businessman became immortal in the Torah world, and the one that was Torah is known, but nowhere approaches the accomplishments, the knowledge, the reputation of his brother. So now we have three basic books. We have the Rif, we have the Rambam, and we have the Rosh, and really the Tur. Now, Ashkenazic Jewry had one way of life. They had one way of looking at life. They had one way of customs, far different than the Sephardim. With a different milieu. Most of the time, the Sephardim had lived under Islam. The Ashkenazim lived under Christianity. In the Middle Ages, that also was a great, great difference. There were many other differences as well. And these three books, therefore, the Tur and the Rosh together as one, and the Rambam and the Rif were the controlling books in Halacha. The Jews are expelled from Spain in 1492. They're driven out. In being driven out, many of them, maybe as many as 30,000, come to the land of Israel. They settle in various cities, but the city of Tzfat becomes a center of Jewish life, a center of Jewish learning, even greater than Jerusalem. There's a rabbi in Tzfat, Rabbi Yaakov Beirav, who feels that this is the messianic era that's coming. The troubles of the expulsion of the Jews in Spain is the prelude towards the coming of the messianic era. And he says that according to the traditions of the Jewish people, the Messiah will be preceded by the reestablishment of the Sanhedrin, by the reestablishment of the main Jewish Supreme Court that decides all halachot. The Sanhedrin went out of business in the 5th century, and there was nobody, in order to be a member of the Sanhedrin, you had to be ordained by someone who was a member of the Sanhedrin. And if they were in the 5th century, they're all dead. So 1,000 years later, how are you going to reconstitute it? So he used an interesting artifice that the Rambam quotes in his great work of Halacha. The Rambam says that if the wise men of Israel, of the land of Israel, not of Israel, only the wise men who live in the land of Israel count. If the wise men who live in the land of Israel will gather and will decide that one of their members is worthy of such ordination, then collectively they have the right to renew that ordination. And once it's renewed, that one who received it will then be able to ordain the 70 others, and we'll have the Sanhedrin back again. And Rabbi Yaakov Beirav, who was the leading scholar in the land of Israel, calls this convention, and many of the great rabbis come, and they all agree with him, and they grant the smicha, they grant the ordination to him, to Rabbi Yaakov Beirav, who in turn turns around and grants the ordination to many, many other great rabbis, including Rabbi Yosef Karo, who is living in Tzfat. And they really are enthused that they're going to rebuild the Sanhedrin, and in rebuilding the Sanhedrin, the Messiah is going to come. That's how they're going to help bring the Messiah. There were, however, rabbis that disagreed, as there always are. And the Rav of Yerushalayim, Reb Levi Ibn Chaviv, the Ralbach, was the chief opponent. But the rabbi in Cairo, in Egypt, the Radvaz, Reb David Ibn Zimra, and other great rabbonim said, no, that the Rambam's opinion is a minority opinion, and that we somehow we will be unable to reconstitute the Sanhedrin, that's the Messiah's job. That's the prophet Elijah's job. There's nothing we can do about it. And therefore, this entire exercise was really an exercise in futility. That's what they said. Rav Yaakov Beirav realized that a Sanhedrin that is controversial, that half of the rabbis say doesn't have authority, is of no value. So what happened was that the smicha died again. Nobody gave it out anymore because they realized that it would be fruitless to do so, be useless. And this opportunity went glimmering. In the books of history of the Jewish people, they always played a game, what if? What if the Sanhedrin would have gone through? But history, it's interesting to play what if, but it's not practical. You can't reverse it. But what happened then is that Rabbi Yosef Karo attempted to write a book that would be the substitute for the Sanhedrin. It wouldn't be a Sanhedrin, but there would be a book now that answered all that, that told Jews how to live. And that book was the Shulchan Aruch. And interestingly enough, he adopted the order of the Tur in writing so that the Shulchan Aruch and the Tur match each other paragraph by paragraph, category by category, number by number. And the Shulchan Aruch, he said at the beginning, how would he decide matters that were in dispute? So he said he would decide it by the rule of the majority. And the three books that he would use would be the Rif, that we discussed, the Rambam, naturally, and the Tur Rosh. Well, in effect, he was saying that he would always side with the Svardim, because there are two Svardim against one Ashkenazi. In Krakow, at the same time, the 1540s, there's a young rabbi by the name of Rabbi Moshe Iserlish. And Rabbi Moshe Iserlish, the Ramo, receives the copy of the Shulchan Aruch. I mean, he really is the linchpin of Jewish history, because he could have said, as many Ashkenazic rabbis of his time said, we're going to ignore this book. I mean, it's a book of the Sephardim. It's like, what's it got to do with us? But what he did is he adopted the book, and he adopted the order of the book, except where the Ashkenazic custom or the Ashkenazic psak differed, he wrote in the lines, in parentheses, that's not our custom, or we'd follow this rule. Now what that did is it made one book. Now the book became both the book for the Ashkenazim and the Sephardim, because it reflected everybody's opinion. Now the Shulchan Aruch also had great criticism leveled against it. The Marshal and others all criticized it. They said, you know, everybody's going to think that they can decide questions of halacha. Everybody will think they just open the book and all the answers are there. Nobody's going to study the Talmud anymore. Nobody's going to do any research. There won't be any creativity left in Jewish learning. But all the criticisms of the book, no matter how great the critic was, fell by the wayside. And the book became the book of Psak. The Ashkenazim followed the parentheses of the Ramah, and the Sephardim followed the bold print of Rabbi Yosef Karo, but everybody knew the other person's opinion as well, because it was always published as one book. So the Sephardim were aware of what the Ashkenazim said, and the Ashkenazim were aware of what the Sephardim said. You didn't have to go out and buy other books. It was all there in that one book. Now the Rambam had said, regarding his book, that if you have my book, he said, you don't need any other books. So the Lord paid him back, so to speak, that there had been no book in Jewish history that has had as many books written about it as the Rambam's book. Last year alone here in Israel, over 300 books were published as commentaries to the Rambam. There are thousands of books that are commentaries on the Rambam. Well, the same thing happened with the Shulchan Aruch. The Shulchan Aruch was supposed to be the end, right? The bottom line. But what happened was that there came throughout the ages commentaries upon commentaries upon commentaries as to the decisions of the Shulchan Aruch. So that in the average Shulchan Aruch that is published today, printed today, there are at least 50 commentaries on the original book, printed in the book itself. On top of that, there are tens of other books written to explain, comment, disagree, support the ideas of the Shulchan Aruch. Beginning in the 19th century, because it became such a pile of things, so then there started abridgments, small Shulchan Aruchs, like the Kitzer Shulchan Aruch, the small Shulchan Aruch of Shlomo Gansfried in Czechoslovakia, the Chaye Odom in Danzig in Lithuania. So the Chaye Odom was studied in all the yeshivas in Lithuania. And it was an abridgment of the Shulchan Aruch. But what happened was that the abridgments also created commentaries, explanations. Because then you ran into the same problem. Where did he get it from? Why did he decide like him? Why didn't he decide like him? In the Lithuanian rabbinate, the rabbis always followed the opinion of the Aruch HaShulchan, who was Reb Yechiel Michal Alevi Epstein, who was the Rav in Novaradok. And he rewrote the Shulchan Aruch, basically rewrote it, shortened it, explained it, and came to decisions. He said clearly what is and what isn't. And I know from my father-in-law, blessed memory, the Lithuanian, and from other Lithuanian rabbonim, they would go up the wall with him, whatever he said. He was the Rav. It wasn't the Mishnah Brewer, it wasn't anybody else. It was whatever the Aruch HaShulchan said. The Chofetz Chaim, beginning in the 1880s, began his great work on Aruch Chaim. The Aruch HaShulchan is again on all four sections. But on Aruch Chaim, the Chofetz Chaim began the Mishnah Brura, which is an encyclopedic work which quotes everybody and also comes to a decision. And the Mishnah Brura gained great, great popularity in the yeshivas especially, and because of the holy nature of its author. And therefore, it became the Book of Psak. Today we have commentaries on the Mishnah Brura. So that we have almost an unending series of books to try and tell us what the bottom line is. And anyone that wants to do research today on halacha has to deal literally with almost 1,400 years worth of books, one piled on the other, in order to determine what the halachas are. In our time, especially in English, but it exists here in Hebrew as well, there are encyclopedic works on individual halachas. There's 300 pages on Sfira, there's 300 pages on what kind of esrig to buy. It has become such a specialized field. It's like lahavdil medicine. So there was a time, you know, you could be a general practitioner. Then you became a specialist. But today you're a subspecialist. You're an expert on one, because the knowledge is so great today and the technology is so great today that you can't be everything. Well, that's happened in halacha as well. And therefore you have people who are experts. This one's an expert in Shabbos, and this one's an expert in Sukkah, and this one's an expert in family matters, and this one's an expert in monetary matters. But the expertise has become specialized. Finally, you have added to all of these works of halacha, you have the thousands of books of responsa that the rabbis have written over the centuries, responsa to questions that were asked them. And this also has a tremendous effect on what the halacha is. So if you want to know what the decision is, many times you can't find it in the Shulchan Aruch, and you won't be able to find it even in the commentaries on the Shulchan Aruch or in the commentaries on the commentaries. But you will find it in the responsa. Rabbi Feinstein is probably the greatest example of it here in Israel, Abshayma Zalman Auerbach. The Chazon Ish was an example of that, where thrust to have the conclusion is no longer found in the legal books, but is found in the response of the rabbis in the correspondences that they had one with another. So we have the books of halacha are living. They're all alive. And it's creative. And there are new ones all the time. And that's the process of the oral law, which always has creativity to it. And also the fact that there are new questions and new technology, new situations, problems that weren't imagined before and have to be dealt with. So therefore, we can expect that the books of halacha will continue to develop and will continue to expand, and that creativity will remain within Israel for all time.
This concludes the fourth lecture in the series, number 498, entitled The Codes of Jewish Law by Rabbi Beryl Wein. For information, please contact the Destiny Foundation at 1-800-499-WINE. That's 1-800-499-9346. We can also be reached by email at info@jewishdestiny.com. Shop online at www.jewishdestiny.com. www.rabbiwine.com. Due to copyright laws, we kindly request that there be no duplication of this lecture except through the Destiny Foundation.